cheer up, a goddess. That was what my life had become.
That was a unique circumstance,
she countered, shaking her head. I had an opportunity to do something, and I took it. Blind luck, how it turned out, I think, she shrugged. It changed the course of the war, I pointed out, not to mention my economic status. The powers of the gods usually work best when used passively like that, she explained. A few might manifest to take direct action, Harris and Duin most often, but our ephemeral nature makes it challenging. Could you persuade the other gods to join the fight? I proposed. That might be helpful. Seeing Duin's great battle axe in action against the Gavanni would be a religious experience by definition.
It was circumstance that allowed me to incarnate, and a lot of emotional energy. Trying to arrange that for the entire pantheon would be almost impossible. It takes human belief and devotion to even bring us into existence. To sustain that takes a lot of focus and, to be candid, not all of the gods are necessarily the brightest candle in the shrine, if you get my meaning. Some are powerful but limited in their sphere, and some pursue agendas they alone understand.
You're really not inspiring a lot of faith, I pointed out.
It gets the bread baked, she shrugged. Look, humanity's very existence on Kalador is a fluke, and if it hadn't been for our manifestation and intercession in events, you would be extinct, and I would be a cultural footnote in some forgettable Alcaalon epic about the tragic death of the lost Humani. Faith may not be the answer for everything, but it's been known to move mountains, and sink islands, and destroy civilizations, she added.
Another fair point, I sighed. All right, if the gods can't come leaping to our defense, just what can you do for us in our hour of need?
Provide inspiration, she decided after a moment's thought. While we are powerful within our spheres, we're merely reflections of the collective human imagination. Our role is not to guide or direct, but to provide you the tools and the inspiration to figure out a way out of your problems. The snowstone, for instance, gives you leverage and resources where you had none.
You're welcome. I appreciate it, I nodded sincerely, and I see your point. So you can inspire me and give me magical gifts, in exchange for my belief and devotion.
Which hasn't been, shall we say, exactly regular, she smirked. And you make it sound so cheap when you say it like that. Transactional, she said distastefully.
I've been busy, I replied flatly. I'm sure my father has taken up the slack. He's gotten a lot more religious as he's gotten older.
I know. Well, if you are in need of inspiration, I'm the right goddess, she agreed.
Suddenly a cascade of bright yellow flame enveloped her from foot to crown. I shrank back from the sudden heat and light reflexively, but it was gone before I could glance back at her. She was holding a small red glass vial with an elegantly simple ruby stopper.
This is just a symbol, she explained. My blessing and inspiration, all in one neat little metaphorical potion.
She started to hand it to me, then stopped and drew back.
Speaking of the transactional nature of human-divine relations, she said, a little guiltily, it's traditional that you pledge some worthy act of devotion or service to indicate your dedication and commitment.
It was my turn to chuckle.
So now you want to haggle?
It's tradition, she repeated. Don't discount the importance of such things, Minilan. They might seem trite, but they help cement the working relationship between the gods and humanity.
I suppose altruism is too human a weakness to be appreciated by the divine.
We do plenty of charity miracles, she argued. But you're hardly a charity case now, are you?
Yet another fair point. The problem is, I'm already building you a temple in town. I don't suppose that would count.
It's a start, but this is bigger than just a temple, she sighed.
Then what? I thought for a few moments. What to do for her? A bonfire? A poetry contest? Start a convent for fosterlings? Nothing seemed particularly worthy of the gift of divine inspiration.
You know, You goddesses are really hard to shop for.
It doesn't have to be anything gaudy, she insisted. Something tasteful and profound. I suppose...
Wait, I said, suddenly remembering something. Maybe I did have something to offer a goddess. I've heard it said that the nature of the gods involved temporary but self-constructing enneagrams, similar to a simple elemental. Am I correct?
In essence,
she agreed, we arise from the collective human subconscious. Kalidor's magosphere gives us context, and humanity's needs and desires give us form and personality. We usually adopt the shape and manner constructed of an amalgam of human perceptions about what we should be, and we often adopt the likeness of a particularly favored devotee. So, there's a woman out there in the world who looks like this, I asked appreciatively. I'm married, not dead, and she was a goddess.
Charmer,
she accused.
Yes, once, a high priestess in Vor named Sarsilla. About 300 years ago. She was the one who promoted my cult amongst the early invaders of the Empire. I liked her. Enough to take her form as my default. Those formative years are important for a developing divinity.
And you manifest when human need calls you into existence.
Essentially. The truth is, we don't exactly understand why it happens, usually. One moment you're in a comfortable state of metaphysical torpor, and the next... you're standing in front of some sweaty baker who needs to beg a boon. When the need for us is sated, we fade back into metaphysical torpor. Why does it happen sometimes and not others? We don't know. We rarely stay around long enough to be able to study the matter, nor do we always retain knowledge gained while corporeal. It's complicated.
What if I could uncomplicate it for you? I proposed.
What? How?
The goddess demanded, what if I could affix your temporal existence permanently, give you control over how and where and when you were able to be incarnate?
What are you talking about?
So much for divine omniscience.
Well, goddess,
I said smugly, when I wasn't droning mindful prayers and faithfully burning candles at your shrine, I was investigating this wondrous mountain you gifted me with. I've managed to get some experts from the Alka Alon and the Karshak Alon, and among the pretties they excavated so far is a stone that has the ability to permanently fix an enneagrammatic pattern.
What do you mean, permanently?
She demanded, as in forever and ever. I enchanted a water elemental in the mill pond. Take a look, if you can stand it.
It's self-sustaining,
I said proudly. It hasn't degraded one bit. It's been humming along without additional help for months now.
And you believe that you could use this device to give me control over my body?
That's at least a strong possibility, I agreed. We're still doing research, but it looks likely. I have the stone right here, I said, patting the pouch at my belt. I had taken to carrying around several of the unique stones to examine in idle moments. To be honest, my belt and the hidden cave were the only places I felt they were truly secure. I could make an attempt right now. She looked at me, her expression unreadable. That had been one beautiful priestess.
You're serious?
I'm willing to make the attempt, I agreed. There are no guarantees, of course. It could lock you into a permanently corporeal state, for all I know. But it's never been tried before, to my knowledge. And I can't think of any thaumaturgical reason it wouldn't work. But, well, I'm not a theurge. I don't know enough about the nature of the gods to be certain. I was hoping you would be able to give me some insight into the matter. She looked thoughtful and furiously torn for a few silent moments. Then she looked up at me sharply.
Minilan,
do you have any idea what that would mean?
I wouldn't have to double the size of your temple.
She ignored me. For the gods to have control over the one thing that has always eluded us?
Minilan, that could change everything.
It would certainly make going to services more interesting, I agreed. You'd never know who you'd run into.
Stop joking, she commanded. This is a serious matter. I had no idea that the effect of that spell would create... But I suppose it makes sense. with the great eye unoccluded and the generative forces involved? You might be telling the truth.
Of course I'm telling the truth, but I told you it might not work. I've only used it a couple of times, and never on anything as enneagrammatically complex as a divinity. There is risk in failure.
There is risk in success, too, she admitted. Do you know what would happen if the gods were thus changed? What renewed role we could play in the lives of the human race? And what forces would be automatically arrayed against us? Should we take that course?
I'm guessing that Sherul would not be too happy, I grinned.
He is not with whom I am concerned, believe it or not. Should the Alka Alon learn of your complicity in this? They would not be too happy either.
The Alka Alon? I thought they got along with the Humani gods.
In general, there have been some problems in the past. But one reason we get along so well with them is that we go away after a while. To them, that's our saving grace. Otherwise, we would be permanent pests to them, constantly looking after humanity's interests, interfering in the affairs of the high and mighty Alkan lords. We'd be an utter pain in their collective ass, she warned.
You say that like it's a negative, I shrugged. I like the Alka Alon, but they aren't perfect.
It's not a matter of perfection. It's a matter of territory. Minilan, what you offer is far, far beyond what I was proposing to give you. This has the possibility of fundamentally changing the nature of power on Kalador.
I like to make a statement when I do something. I dismissed. You wanted a gesture of devotion. I'm offering you one. She bit her lip nervously. I had made a goddess nervous. This was getting better and better.
You realize that this would become a permanent alliance? She said in a very low voice. And for a time, a secret alliance?
I'm not sure I'd have much credibility if I went around bragging about it, I pointed out. In fact, I don't think that more than a handful of people would even consider believing me if I told them you had manifested for me. As far as a permanent alliance? Well, let's just say you put the spellmonger on a healthy retainer when you delivered my son safely to me. A permanent retainer. The rationalization apparently appealed to her.
Very well, then. I accept your generous offer, Minilan, and the risks associated with it. Nor will I communicate this with the other gods until we are sure of the effect.
No one has to know, I agreed. It can be our little secret. She made a face.
You aren't seducing me. You're enchanting me.
I chuckled again. No, my beautiful goddess, it is you who are enchanting me. I couldn't resist. She blushed.
I made a goddess blush.
I didn't know what to do with that information. Before she could continue the banter, I dug into my pouch and withdrew the wrapped stone in question. This might hurt, if a goddess can feel pain, or it might not. Hells, I have no idea what it will feel like. The water elemental never commented. Ready?
Ready,
she affirmed, after taking a deep breath. I began the spell. The next morning, the entire episode seemed like a faint and distant dream. Partially because of the divine nature of the encounter, and partly because my actual dreams, once I had downed the sweet-tasting metaphorical potion, were filled with images and scenarios and ideas. With Brigger's help, my slumbering mind tore through the problem from every angle, applying every resource I had or could imagine to the situation. In the morning, when I woke up next to the empty red bottle on my bedside table, I knew exactly what I had to do. There was no guarantee. There was no certainty. It was risk upon risk, a gamble with no sure winners and no sure losers. I would be, in essence, staking everything on the outcome. It was a heady feeling. As I washed, dressed, and stumbled downstairs to the great hall for breakfast, the requirements for my plan suggested themselves to me neatly, one after the other, in proper order. I don't know what metaphorical liquor had been in that metaphorical bottle, but it had done the trick. I had a plan. An elaborate, risky, bold, and ambitious plan with so much room for disastrous error that I shuddered to consider it. But it was a plan.
a plan with the hope and possibility of success. I began contacting people mind to mind as soon as my porridge and ale were set in front of me. By tradition, breakfast was the one meal where we did not stand on ceremony, and theoretically, anyone in the castle could approach me with a question, complaint, or request. But when I sat by myself at the cracked stone high table, people generally left me alone. First, I contacted Telemann and told him enough of my plan to get some things happening at Castle Gavard. He was skeptical at first. He wouldn't have been a decent military commander if he wasn't. But once he saw what I wanted to do, he accepted the plan in good faith. He agreed to start issuing orders and preparing. I think he was just happy that someone had a plan. Then I contacted Pentandra, who had been transferred back to her estate near Castabriel. I came closest to revealing my liaison with Brigga to her, but refrained from mentioning any specific names. I merely told her the gods had helped me figure it out, and left it at that. Thankfully, she accepted my explanation without further inquiry. She can be nosy when she feels like it. But considering how much I asked her to do in such a short period of time, she didn't have the luxury of questioning the origin of my plan. After I finished with Penny, I spoke with four or five other high magi whose talents I'd need, and by the time I was done, the last of my porridge was stone cold. "Excellency?" Serif interrupted when he saw me sigh and push my bowl away. He was filling in for Sire Kay as temporary castellan, while Kay was deployed in Gilmora. I suppose it got pretty boring at his crappy little castle in his backwater fief, and I'm sure the money was good. And, of course, he had a crush on Lady Fallowen.
"You look pensive this morning. Are you feeling well?"
"A late night and too many problems, my friend," I sighed. "Thank you for inquiring, but I think I have come to some resolution on the matter."
"Is there something I can be of assistance with?"
he asked politely. I'd noticed Serif had improved his dress and grooming since he had become my vassal. No doubt Lady Fallowen's occasional presence had something to do with it.
"Actually, there is. You're acting castellan. I need a message sent to every domain in the barony. I'm recruiting men for a highly dangerous campaign. Volunteers only, veterans only, single men only. Rich reward. And the not inconsiderable favor of the spellmonger," I added. "I need them here by dusk, day after tomorrow, armed for infantry work. Spears, swords, bows. Leave the lances at home. There's not going to be any cavalry charges."
"Yes, Excellency,"
Serif said, snapping to attention. He might have been hesitant as an acting baronial castellan, but he knew how to take military orders.
"I shall have the scribe prepare it at once, and spread the word among my garrison. I'm not going to tell any man to go. He's going to have to want to go, and there's a very good chance he might not come back. But if he does, I'll make it worth his while."
"Just where are we headed, Excellency?"
he asked hesitantly. "West, to the Mindens. So tell them to dress warmly, then send word to the Karshak Lodge that I crave a moment with Master Guri when he has an opportunity. Sooner would be better than later."
"It shall be done, Excellency,"
he assured me. "Lastly, I want you personally to go inform the Alka Alon atop Matten's Helm that we prepare to go into battle. Anyone who wants to go along with us needs to be ready to go at the appointed hour."
Is there any chance Milady Fallowen will be there?"
he asked, hopefully. "She is currently helping evacuate her people from her homeland in the far west," I explained, realizing that the country knight probably didn't know much about what was going on. "That's where the bulk of the Gavani army is headed, not Gilmora. And Fatiel, the legendary city of rainbows, High Alka Alon Citadel, since before humans were spawned from the void. We're going to go help relieve it."
"Lady Fallowen's city?"
he asked, alarmed.
"Yes,"
I admitted. "And Fatiel. It is under threat. Sherul fainted at Gilmora to strike there instead."
"Well, that must not be borne,"
he declared, offended at the idea. "That's kind of why we're going to attack them," I agreed casually. "That's why I need these men. High-quality men. Tough men. Where we're going, the weak and faint-hearted will fail. Quality will matter more than quantity. Veterans, not recruits. Infantry, not cavalry. If a knight is all elbows on foot, I don't care how valiantly he can charge into battle horsed."
"I shall see it done, Excellency," he said,
and stomped off resolutely to do so. I liked Sariv. He was uncomplicated. I raised my hand to get Atal Alon's attention. They were now our regular serving attendants at the castle for most things, to get a second bowl of porridge when there was a ruckus at the door. It proved to be a village lad from Sevendor Town, bearing tidings. At dawn the town had awakened to a new and mysterious sign in their midst. Down in the old commons area, on the site designated for the new temple quarter, a column of flame, 10 feet high, had sprung up from the ground on the proposed site of Brigger's Temple. It was a gaudy pillar of sparkling red, gold, and orange, and it seemed to manifest without the need of fuel. While hot, it was fire. One could apparently stand but a few inches away and not be burnt. The townspeople were perplexed. Was it another spell gone wrong? A secret plan of the spellmonger? An attack from Sherul? A portent of things to come? A sign from the gods? I calmed the boy down, listened to his story, and indicated that I found the last most likely. This is clearly a sign of favor from the Bright One, I said gently, a symbol of her support for our war effort. Spread the word. The gods themselves are on our side in this struggle. I gave the boy a silver piece and sent him happily back to the town. By noon, the word of the unexpected blaze had spread like, well, like wildfire, and the site became a place of impromptu pilgrimage. It was quickly called the Everfire, as it did not wane, though not a stick of fuel fed it. The workers scheduled to begin digging the foundation to the temple were perplexed. I felt for them, but didn't have time to stop and help them sort through the thorny problem of building a temple around a perpetual fire hazard. I had other things to do. But sign of divine favor energized the people. While my summons did not explicitly mention it, each messenger was full of tales of the Everfire springing up amidst the snow that never melted. It was great for recruitment, we'd discover later. At the time, I just looked into the crackling fire on the hearth of the Great Hall and silently invoked Brigger. Show off, I prayed to the laughing, dancing flames. Chapter 30 The Barges of Durrow. Of course, the plan wasn't as easy to execute as it had been in my dream. Your mind is really good about neglecting to mention all the sweat involved in making dreams come true. Assembling a strike force was the first task. My call for volunteers yielded a few hundred men fitting the bill, with a large number of Bovali interested in striking the hated Gavani again. There were also adventurers, mercenaries, veterans looking for the reward, and eager soldiers tired of garrison duty and interested in adventure. I had no intention relying on my levy as my main force, but every bit of manpower would help. I wanted daring killers and experienced warriors. I had plenty of gold. I got what I paid for. The Alka Alon, too, contributed 100 more human-sized archers to the cause. Some were actually from Amphatiel and wanted to rescue their fair city. Others were so outraged at the temerity of the Gavani that they felt compelled to avenge the affront. I didn't care about their motivations. I needed their bows. And their magic. Speaking of magic, I recruited a number of war magi by the simple expedient of going down to the Enchanter's Street in town and letting it be known I needed help. There were always a few magi scrounging around for work in Sevendor, and word spread quickly. I found 4 who were willing and worthy of advancement. I gave them each witch stones and had Bannermore help them acclimatize to the stones. Meanwhile, I had Castle Gavard astir from afar. Telamon had quietly spread the message that the spellmonger had need of all high magi for a mission, and, with certain exceptions, called everyone who could make it to Gavard. Then there were my other preparations. I had to impose on Lady Varen to transport me via a nearby waypoint to a town called Durrow, a few miles downriver of Gavard, in an area generally unaffected by the invasion. A small force had passed by them as they made their way down the river, but their stockade and their guardsmen had proven too strong, and the goblins had moved on to easier targets. Durrow was a small town, but it was at the confluence of the Poros and the northwardly Kaolin River, and it saw a lot of traffic back when Gilmora grew cotton, not goblins.
Darrow's claim to fame was as the disembarkation point for most of the region's cotton after it had been sold at market. Every year a flotilla of brightly painted barges, specially designed for hauling huge bales of cotton, was launched after the harvest and a proper festival. The barges used were too large for normal commercial traffic. They were reserved for the cotton harvest, then carefully taken back out of the water for the next year. Each was owned by a different merchant trading house, who each had agents in Durrow just to deal with the harvest barges. The town had fallen on hard times recently, and many of the barges, once used to ferry cotton down to the coast, had been taken out of the water. That meant that they hadn't been crushed by the instantly expanding ice of the river, as so many boats had been. The masters of the town were perplexed when I showed up and started barking orders. I had to show them my marshal's warrant to get them to listen to me. I had to start throwing gold around to convince them I was serious. It took half a day, but soon there were half a dozen blacksmiths making the modifications I desired. Once I was reasonably sure that they knew what I needed, and that they would be well paid for the result, they went to their task with purpose. Satisfied, I had Lady Varen take me to our next stop. We met up with Lady Athalia in a glade in eastern Gilmora, where she had just finished off the last marauding pack of fellhounds in the region. I didn't have much time, but I explained to her what I needed.
"You want to make more of them?"
she asked, confused. "Yes, only I want them to be a little friendlier. To us."
"Where could I possibly find the base stock?"
she demanded. "You'll think of something. You're resourceful that way. But I need as many as you can manage at Gavard as soon as possible." She looked at me skeptically.
"What are you planning, Master Menelan?"
she asked accusingly. "I'm trying to save Anthatiel," I replied. "They're essential to my plan."
"So, you're not going to tell me?"
she asked warily. "No. Not until I have to. It would just distract you. Everyone has a task. This one is yours." She considered the matter.
"I may have to consult my grandmother on this,"
she admitted.
"I don't know if it's ever been done before."
"It worked on the falcons," I pointed out. "We might need more of those, too." She gave me a sour look. "When you have time," I conceded. "I know you're busy. 3 days, Ithalia. I need them in 3 days at Gavard. No later." She nodded.
"I think I can do it,"
she sighed.
"You don't ask for small boons, do you, spellmonger?"
"What would be the point? If you have any friends who want a chance to kill goblins, bring them along." Then I had Lady Varen bring me back to Sevendor. It had been an exhausting day, but I had set plenty in motion. I got back to Sevendor Castle near midnight, tired, but genuinely hopeful for the first time in days. I stopped by the chapel on the way upstairs to my chambers. I passed by the eternal pillar of flame Brigger had conjured in the middle of town on my way back from the embassy. It had served to remind me of whom I had to thank for my mad idea. It was empty, so I lit a candle and threw Brigger a prayer. She didn't answer. She didn't manifest. The candles may have burned a little brighter, but that could have been my imagination. I tumbled into bed next to Alia, the kids in their cradles nearby. It was warm and soft and peaceful. It was utterly at odds with what I knew was to come in the days ahead. I fell asleep, thinking about the advantages of letting the Alka Alon and the Gavani fight it out, while we conspired with the Tal Alon to perfect the ideal ale recipe. The next morning, I prepared to return to the war. Alia, quite understandably, didn't want me to go, but knew I had to. The last time, a few weeks earlier, she had made her peace with losing me to the war effort for a while, and though the sight of me returning so early had thrilled her, she knew it was temporary. She did her best to get me ready and put a smile on my face while my volunteers assembled in the outer bailey. I donned my special armor, newly repaired and cleaned by our staff, and added some other things to my baggage I thought I might need. Much of it I stored in an interdimensional pocket I'd crafted in a ring. It was just easier to carry that way. My apprentices were armored, armed, ready and waiting. Dara had Frightful and the other falcons in small form to facilitate transport, and the Hawkmaster was coming with us to tend them. With them were just under 300 Sevendori volunteers who had been found acceptable and approved for the journey. Most were armored and prepared to fight as infantry. All had at least some previous combat experience, and not enough sense to avoid this suicide mission. I surveyed the brave men of the Bontal who had enlisted to my service. I had them called to order and walked through the rows, inspecting them, seeing some familiar faces and a few new. And one that was quite familiar. "Sir Riv," I asked, surprised to see the knight in full battle dress.
"I, Mage Lord?"
he asked, curious. "What brings you on this journey? I thought your duties were keeping you here."
"It was Sir Ranelagh's turn to stand for duty," he explained. "I thought you could use an extra hand."
"Me and the Lady Fallowen," I supplied. The young knight blushed, but said nothing. "Glad to have you," I added, clapping him on the shoulder and moving on. When all were ready, I had Lady Verin begin the song spell. It was a fraction of the army the Alcaalon had moved through the waypoints last year, 2 years ago, at Cambrian, and no horses. She still strained, but after the feeling of being hurled through reality ceased, we came to rest in Gilmora, outside of Gavard Castle. Once we'd recovered, we began the short walk to the fort. There were plenty more troops awaiting us when we arrived. Wenek brought a wild-looking troop of hillmen from the Pearwoods, including a few semi-barbaric war magi he'd been cultivating. Astaral brought nearly every spark in Tudri down, with Lady Verin's help, through the waypoints, and Azar appeared with what must have been every war mage left in the penumbra. Taran arrived from Wenshar with another few. All were camped out in the Bailey in tournament pavilions. I was greeted 100 times before I made it to the door of the Great Hall, where Pentandra, Arborn, and Terlaman were waiting. Penny had escorted the non-combatants of the Magical Corps here from their complex. After they had dealt with the marauders in their region, there was precious little else for them to do. But I had a job for them. According to my divinely inspired plan, I had jobs for them all. "More troops?" Terlaman asked, as my men marched by. "I figured a few more wouldn't hurt," I shrugged. "They aren't being paid by the Crown's coin. They're my men. They're loyal and tough. All volunteers," I said proudly.
"I, too, brought more men," Arborn said quietly. "The elders at Kassar agreed the need was great enough. Our debt to the Alcaalon is steep. 1,000 rangers will arrive by morning."
Pentandra looked thrilled. It did, of course, make my 300 seem inadequate. But Arborn could have showed up with a couple of drunken Tal, and she would have approved. Penny loses all sense of perspective when she likes a man.
"Everyone else is here, save Fallowen and Ithalia," she explained. "And I mean everyone. Over 130 high magi."
That was about how many I had started with. "I brought a few more. Have them gather tonight after dinner in the Great Hall. I'll address them and explain our battle plan."
"Good,"
Terlaman nodded curtly. "Rad has been asking for updates, and asking suspicious-sounding questions. He's under the impression that we might be up to something. I've been stalling him, telling him about the clean-up work and the pursuit of the remaining large forces in Gilmora, and generally bullshitting him to keep him quiet."
"We've had help with that," Pentandra agreed. "Count Salgo. He doesn't want to see any royal troops go with you either, but he's happy to support us in this. Whatever this is."
"An independent military adventure," I decided. "Emphasis on the adventure. We are not acting as agents of the king or representing the kingdom. We are acting as agents..."
"Save it for the crowd," Pentandra said, holding up a hand. "I think I want to be surprised."
"I'll be surprised if it bloody works at all," I muttered. "I'm wondering if we aren't preparing for a disaster."
"Disaster or not, at least you're doing something," Terlaman agreed expressively. "It kills me to sit here and know there are Gavani a few miles north of the river, and we're forbidden to go after them. And the army up the Poros is wrecking everything in sight on their way to that lake town."
"And Thatiel," I nodded.
"It's utterly gorgeous, literally. Makes Carnaduin look like a hamlet. But it will be very, very difficult to get to."
"That's what we're counting on, I suppose,"
Terlaman mused. "And we were. After dinner that night, after everyone had gotten settled in,
I had the High Magi congregate in the Great Hall, along with the captains and military commanders who had volunteered to make the journey. I looked around at a sea of faces, most of which I knew. A few I knew intimately. I found a sturdy trestle near the fire and stood upon it, amplifying my voice with magic so that all could hear. My friends, my colleagues, my fellow professionals, I have summoned you here tonight because our kingdom has great need of magic, and we are the ones responsible for providing it. We prepared a stout defense here, and it was bypassed. We prepared for a great slaughter in Gilmora, but ended up chasing wild dogs instead. While some see this as a gift from the gods, the fact remains that the army we thought was destined for here has another target. Now Shurul sets his ambitions on no less than one of the greatest citadels of the Alka Alon, a great and powerful fortress, high in the mountains, surrounded by a lake, which is now frozen over. Their gates are frozen open. Their arcane defense is nullified. They plan to mount as brisk a defense as they can, and it will be stout. But there is a limit to what even the Alka Alon can do against such sorcery as Shurul directs at them. I have taken counsel with the Alka Alon elders, and they will fight for Anthatiel, as much as they are able. But even if the gods favor them, there is little hope that they will be able to repel such a force as is arrayed against them. Things are that dire. So what hope do we, mere Humani, have against the Gavani when the mighty Alka Alon may fail? We have our ingenuity, our dedication, our ferocity, and with that we have a chance against a foe much larger than we are. There will be three groups, I announced, pacing across the long table to be heard by all. The largest will journey up the river to pursue the Gavani main army. The second will be the non-combatants. They will have the task of breaking Shurul's spell on the Poros at the proper time. The third will be a special combat unit dedicated to doing what is needed by the non-combatant Magi to secure the spell. If we work in coordination, then our efforts should be fruitful. How and why, I do not wish to share at this time. There is a lot that could go wrong with this plan, so much that I feel that revealing it in its entirety might do more harm than good. It's not that I don't trust you. It's that we don't have a lot of time and I don't need to spend it explaining my reasoning. Now, I continued, pointing to Terlaman. Commander Terlaman has your assignments. The first group will leave at first light in the morn. If you are on that list, prepare yourself accordingly. The second and third groups will begin working on the problem of the freezing spell once we are underway. That part of the plan is instrumental. Now, any questions? Dozens of hands went up. I picked one at random. How are we supposed to counter the freezing spell? One young mage asked, worriedly. I have no idea, I admitted, but it can be done. Lady Varen will coordinate the effort, and Pentandra will command those magi. How they do it is up to them. When they do it is up to me. You, I said, moving on to the next convenient hand. How are we getting up the Poros? I don't feel inclined to walk that way, another mage said with feeling. I've arranged transportation, I soothed. It will be here in the morning. Next. Why isn't the Royal Army coming? How are we going to get through that rough country? I've been to Western Alshar, it's hard. How many Gavani are really in that column? And worms, and trolls? Why can't we just hire more mercenaries? Why do the Alka Alon need our help? I thought they were the powerful ones. Assuming we actually make it to this fanciful city alive, what the hells are we supposed to do then? The questions kept coming, and I answered dozens before they finally died out. People were nodding. They seemed to understand our priorities, our targets, and our responsibilities. I didn't see a lot of eagerness on anyone's part, but then I didn't see a lot of reluctance either. In fact, there was a noticeable shift in the mood of the magical corps. Most of these war magi had come here expecting to be fighting for their lives against overwhelming odds, defensively, over a bridge. At Timberwatch, at Cambrian, we had been fighting a defensive battle, and this one promised the offense. It made a difference. The shift in the mood encouraged the enthusiasm, even among the non-combatant magi who would stay behind and tried to figure out how to counter the spell. The group who had been selected to attack and execute the plan against the spell was particularly eager. I realized myself that my perspective on the battle had changed. I wasn't a valiant defender this time around. My role was belligerent aggressor, and I found it suited my mood. "Let's get some sleep," I encouraged, as the night bell tolled. "We have mighty things to do in the morning." Things started to come together at dawn the next morning, when 1,000 Kasari rangers rode in. They had been on the road for days, summoned by their elders to assist us. Each one was a raptor, whatever that meant, and each was used to spending months at a time in the wilderness. They were doughty and capable, and their discipline was a lesson to the soldiers of the garrison. Rank after rank of stern, green-cloaked rangers stood at attention for Captain Arborn's inspection. Together with the original group of rangers, the Kasari made up the largest single unit. Grim-faced, dour-handed, these men were the backbone of the force. With them were 1,000 rough-and-tumble volunteers. Most had come from mercenary infantry units, or had reputations for experience, or were personal guards, like my 7 Dori. Among them were a few score remnants of the 2nd Royal Commando, stragglers who had not been caught in the slaughter. They had rallied at Gavard around their war mage, and Count Salgo had made a point of paying the maintenance of the shard of a unit. When the call went out for volunteers, and the Count reluctantly told them that they were ineligible due to their affiliation, the remnant resigned their commission on the spot as a group. They wanted vengeance, and this expedition was their most expedient route to that goal. Then there was the Magical Corps. The High War Magi going represented the most powerful human magi in centuries, and most had been fighting for years. Their sophistication with their stones had grown, their weaponry and armor had improved, and their skills were at their peak. Among them were many of my friends and colleagues, Sayake, my apprentices, Sir Festaren and Lorcus, Azar, Astarol, Carmella, who had left her pointless defensive work in Gilmora to act as our chief engineer, Thinradl, Lance, Landric Taran, Bendanal the Outlaw, Foran Dahl of Robinwing, Wenek of the Pearwoods, Alscott the Fair, and of course, Terlaman, commanding them, resplendent in dark blue armor and cloak, his expensive helmet making him look like the captain he was. Even Master Komoran, aged as he was, had elected to come along with his apprentices. He was an enchanter and a swordsmith, as much as a war mage, but he had seen a lot of battlefields in his time. He did not want to be left out of this adventure, and I think he wanted to see legendary Anthatiel. Lastly were the Alka Alon. There were hundreds who were gathering at their encampment, transgenically enchanting themselves into humanish forms, and arming themselves for war from our stores. For most, this was a novel enterprise, and Onranyan had to take charge and give some basic instruction. Few of the volunteers were seasoned warriors. The mood around the camp had turned tense. Many had been in smaller refuges, as the larger Alkan settlements were guarded now with the serious threat of war. Man for man, they were the most dangerous human beings I'd been able to assemble in the time allotted. All things considered, I decided I'd done fairly well. I'd only needed the assistance of one god. Of course, gathering this powerful but small army together was only the first part of the plan. Getting them up the icy Poros and into battle was the hard second part. The goblins had been force marching, day and night, according to our scouts and scrying reports. Their siege worms pulled massive wains and great loads tirelessly up the river, and as the individual Gavani were exhausted, they rested in them while the march went on. Then they would resume walking while their fellows rested. The pace was slow but relentless. They had moved hundreds of miles upriver while we had been figuring out what to do. They were only a few days from the first ascent of the escarpment that led to the Land of Scars in western Alshar. We had a lot of catching up to do. Our advantage was our size. They had to move 100,000. I had to move 3,000. The temptation to use the Alkan waypoints was strong, but practically speaking, it was nearly impossible to move that many folk through them without starting from Sevendor and using a lot of power. Besides, there were other reasons for taking the long road.
My solution had been twofold. The first involved procuring the surplus cotton barges in dry dock, and having them fitted with makeshift steel runners underneath. The wide, flat barges made ideal transports for personnel, as they did bales of cotton. I'd had to show the Gilmore and Smiths at Durrow how I wanted the blade shaped, and they'd depleted their stores of iron to do so. But I had 20 large barges that could skate across ice now. They weren't the sturdiest craft. They were used primarily to transport the bulk of the cotton harvest downriver, and were therefore built for capacity more than for durability. They were also outlandishly painted, as each Gilmoran trading house tried to attract business with their transports. I'd sent Tyndall and Rondall ahead to secure them and prepare them for their means of propulsion. That's where Ithalia came in. I'd noticed both in Gavard and at Anthatiel that both the fellhounds and the local mongrels had no difficulty padding across the ice with minimal slips. So I'd had Ithalia and her folk gather as many dogs as possible from the abandoned kennels of the Gilmoran manors they were passing, and transgenically enchant the ones most suited to the task. It had been a tall order. Fellhounds were massive, because they'd been secretly bred that way in the mountain lairs of the Gavanni over generations. The average Gilmoran hound is no more than 50 pounds, and the breeds were tended with very specialized tasks in mind. Ithalia had settled on a mixture of racing dogs, herding dogs, and hunting dogs, though she had found a few mutts who had been bred for fighting, a popular though disreputable sport in genteel Gilmora, and had adopted them personally. Apparently, the assignment had inspired a serious case of puppy love in the rustic Alcan noblewoman. After the laborious process of transgenic enchantment, the dogs were 5 times their original size. Hounds that had once herded sheep were now large enough to herd horses. Racers that had once chased rabbit skins around a track now chased sheep and ate them. Hunters who had once pointed and retrieved ducks and pigeons for their masters were now large enough to retrieve a hart with little difficulty. Ithalia had delivered 250 giant dogs to the converted barges at Durrow, and with Rondall and Tyndall overseeing their harnessing, hemp rope, not leather, it was all we had time for, were eventually able to get the hounds leashed to the boats with a lot of helpful spells from Ithalia and her Alcan kin. An hour after dawn, the first of our makeshift sleighs rumbled up the Poros, Tyndall standing triumphantly over a team of 7, surrounded by giant dogs who were enjoying the ride. He explained to me later that the massive mutts seemed far more eager to pull the barges if they got a regular turn at riding. The psychology of dogs is beyond me, but there was no denying the expressions of abject joy on the dogs who were riding. Tongues lolled, tails were wagged. The appearance of the first barge elicited a profound outpouring of wonder and respect. There had been a lot of speculation on just how I'd planned on getting everyone in our little army several 100 miles west up a frozen river. Now they knew. While it wasn't as classy as the waypoints, the gaudily decorated cotton barges and the barking, panting, scratching giant dogs who pulled them got a lot of appreciation. The Kasari were enchanted with the dogs, and a sea of green cloaks and coloured triangles soon surrounded the canine labourers. It didn't take long before they were all hugging and petting the massive beasts like puppies, up to and including rolling around on the ice with them. The dogs seemed delighted at the change in perspective, including the amplified barks they could muster. "I feel like I'm in a bloody temple procession," chuckled Azar, as he stowed his equipment in the lead barge. "Are you sure that there aren't any sweetmeats aboard that I can throw to the kiddies?" "Here are your sweetmeats," Sarakim the archer said, throwing 5 bulging quivers into the barge from the ramp. "Be generous. Don't skimp." "Are you certain that's enough?" Lorcas asked, as he hopped in the boat. "I don't think you brought enough for everyone." "These are just the ones I'm bringing with me," he nodded. "I have more in my baggage with the Alka Alon. The novelty of the transportation compels me to take no chances." "I don't know what you're complaining about," said Lorcas, as he made himself comfortable and took an apple out of his bag. "This is a damn sight better than most of the shipboats I've been on." "It doesn't leak," he pointed out. I had the enchanters among us detailed to see to the blades of the odd craft.
Each one was magically enhanced for durability, friction, and soundness before we left. The barges were enchanted to reduce drag due to air friction. You'd be surprised just how much that can impede progress at any real speed. And of course, the dogs themselves were enchanted. Ithalia and her folk laid spells of endurance and energy upon them, cast spells to protect their paws on the ice, and did some alken trick that made them all behave perfectly when in harness. When we were all loaded up and packed, our 3,000 warriors were spread out over 20 boats, each one pulled by a team of 10 dogs. Additional hounds were scattered among the boats to cycle out as we journeyed. The goblins had taught us that much. I was riding in the lead boat with many of my best people. Captain Arborn elected to join me there. I noticed he and Pentandra having some close words nearby before we boarded.
"Do me a favor, Min,"
she whispered to me after she had bid him farewell and he'd climbed the ramp.
"Can you keep an eye on him for me?"
I stared up at the 6'3" tall, muscular warrior, whose dark eyes and dour look made him appear a hero out of legend. In comparison, I felt like a market conjurer.
Sure, Penny,
I said gently. I'll keep the little tyke out of trouble.
Do that,
she urged, missing the irony completely.
At least you get to go with him.
I'm stuck here with Dunsel and the Dreary. Even Isily has snuck off to get away from him.
The man is repulsive.
Unfortunately, he's also a decent thaumaturge. You're in charge of knocking out that spell, I reminded her. If I have to hold your crush hostage to get it done, I'm not above that.
He's more than a crush, Min,
she said, just above a whisper.
I've never met any man like him. He's so pure. Good. He's too good to be true.
I'll remind you that you said that later, I promised. We'll come back. We'll all come back.
Do that. I'll handle my bit.
I've got the brightest minds at Alar Andinarian Academies working on the thaumaturgical end of it.
We'll come up with something,
she assured me. I hope so, I agreed. Your bridal shower depends upon it.
Don't even joke about that,
she said adamantly, and seriously. In the face of that kind of response, I found other things to do. Dara and her wing of 3 Skyriders would be accompanying us, providing cover and intelligence from the skies. She and the Alken emissaries had successfully cast the spell on 6 birds total now, but only 4 were adequately trained to bear a rider. Her crew included the Hawkmaster, who cared for the birds, and a collection of young people of human and Tal Alon descent who rode them. She had pushed to get 2 more riders aloft for the journey. That only left 2 of her giant birds without riders. I had high hopes for the project, but there were misgivings all around. The riders were young and inexperienced. Their birds were still skittish about the transformation, and there was plenty of danger inherent to the task. They had all volunteered nonetheless. Dara's brother had accompanied them too, a deadly-looking young man who had been in charge of guarding Kaolin's pass for the last year. He looked as eager as any in the company. I went to each of the 20 boats to inspect it for myself, introduce myself, describe the plan yet again, and thank everyone for their trust, faith, and fearlessness. What we were attempting had never been done, and there would likely be sagas written about the attempt, whether it was successful or not. As I was climbing into the lead barge, the dogs anxious to be underway, I heard a shout from below. Just as I was about to pull up the ramp, Lady Varen appeared at its foot.
Master Minolan,
she called in her bell-like voice,
I bid you farewell, and with all the speed your gods can grant you, for I have just received word from Master Harathel. 2 dragons have appeared over Anas Yartharel. They are attacking the citadel.
That was bad news of the highest order. Anas Yartharel was the Alka Alon's greatest fortress. I didn't think it was dragon-proof.
Dear gods,
Lorca said from behind me.
That is not the worst. 3 dragons have appeared over Anthatiel. They are attacking the gates in preparation for the army's assault. You must hurry. Every hour you delay may spell our doom.
Chapter 31 Journey Up the Frozen Poros. I had no idea just how long it would take us to get up the river. The goblin army was ahead of us,
moving slowly but steadily, and we had a lot of distance to cover in a very short time, if we were to get there in a timely fashion. The entire operation was impromptu, and our ability to improvise was challenged every step of the way. With no time to test our novel transportation, once we got in the barges and actually set the dogs to pulling, I was pleasantly surprised to feel the monstrosity lurch forward and begin the journey. It took two drivers to manage the team, and for the most part it was the Kasari who volunteered for the duty. They encouraged the enchanted dogs to make as much speed as possible, and that turned out to be considerable. We passed by the first of the towns despoiled by the goblins within an hour, and it was 20 miles upriver from Gavard. With the enchanted sleigh runners and the enchanted dogs, we made far, far better time than I could have dreamed. We were nearing the 50-mile mark in the afternoon when we made our first stop to water the dogs. They barely seemed winded. Along the way, we passed the telltale signs of the army we were pursuing. Burned-out villages, barges frozen mid-river and burnt to the ice. And whenever some poor fool had been unlucky enough to be caught by the army, their grisly remains were artfully displayed to warn others of lingering too long. The army had stained the ice black with its passing. We tried to avoid the faint rut that ran down the center of the frozen river and stick to one side or the other. The dogs would slow at every fresh sign of the Gavani and whine a bit at whatever bit of offal they had left behind. Unsurprisingly, many times that refuse was composed of individual Gavani who had been unable to keep up. A few times we came across headless Gavani. Apparently Shirul occasionally had discipline issues. The giant siege worm droppings we could have done without. Late on that first day, we came to the site of a battle, the aftermath of which was conclusive. There were hundreds of bodies of both goblin and man piled up on the side of the river, and the entire area was stained with blood. A broad, frozen smear of red, nearly a mile wide, told us the encounter happened before the army passed, and they had not stopped. The night slipped by like the trees on the banks we were speeding past. The entire barge vibrated as the long steel blades were pulled over the rough ice. It produced a kind of loud rumble that soon pervaded your very bones. At first it was unnerving, but then everyone got used to it, and eventually it became kind of soothing. It was too difficult to talk at length over the noise, so most contented themselves with sleeping or speaking mind to mind. I was doing the latter most of the night. I was still receiving updates from the few folk we'd left back at Gavard Castle with Count Salgo. King Rad had been calling through the mirror, but Salgo had put him off, explaining I was on a short, urgent mission and would return directly. That hadn't pleased His Majesty. Rad wasn't exactly aware that the bulk of his kingdom's magical protection was now rumbling up an icy river in a desperate attempt to save a realm he barely knew existed, much less cared for. Nor would he have approved. That was precisely why I hadn't asked him. That was a breach of protocol of the highest order. After all, he had made his intentions clear. I was skirting a technicality by declaring this a mission of the Arcane Orders, as opposed to a strictly military operation, and since I had not used any of Rad's paid troops, except the former remnant of the second commando, I had not technically broken his edict. But I knew he'd be plenty pissed about it when he found out. I couldn't help that. All I could do is hand him a victory that would mean something in the long term. Not mere piles of goblin heads, or even dragon heads, but a real tangible sign of progress in the war. Until he discovered me, I had a job to do. That included extensive mental conversations with a variety of people to discuss the thaumaturgical end of the freezing spell. And while I love to talk shop about thaumaturgy, I prefer to do so over a mug of ale, not freezing my ass off, flying like an arrow down an icy road toward an uncertain doom. Worse, the conversation soon went way beyond my capacity to follow it. We were dealing with Gavani magic of a very specific type, and that was causing some difficulties. Overhead, Dara and her brave Skyriders were scouting ahead and ensuring there were no traps for us to contend with. Apparently the Gavani were not anticipating pursuit, for they left nothing behind to discourage it. Dara's birds were adept at discovering bands raiding on either side of the river, but with time so critical, I could not in good conscience order us to stop. The sensation of speed was novel. Apart from cavalry charges or riding a horse at a gallop, I'd never gone as fast.